We've been to all four corners of Britain in our quest to interview the great and good of entertainment. Comics, actors, writers, politicians, singers, dancers and choreographers. It doesn't matter who they are. They've all given me their own take on the world they live in and have, in their own way, helped to define what makes Britain great. So join me and my assistants as we get another insight into the marvellous and enigmatic world of showbiz here on Beyond the Title.
Journalist and broadcaster Nicholas Owen began his career on the Surrey Mirror in 1964, aged 17, before entering the enigmatic Fleet Street, working as a junior reporter for the Sunday Times. In 1981, he joined the BBC as a reporter for North East Regional News for 3 years until securing the role as business and economics correspondent for Channel 4 News. Between 1991 and 1994, he co-presented the ITN Lunchtime News with the late Carol Barnes before becoming ITN's royal correspondent and presided over significant events, including the funeral of Princess Diana. I caught up with the veteran broadcaster to talk rolling news, television, and recollections on an unparalleled career in broadcasting. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Nicholas Owen. Okay, well, so welcome to Beyond the Title. We'll get on to your major career highlights in a second, but I just want to ask you about the unprecedented times that we're living in. In your opinion, to what extent is the art of broadcast journalism being tested to its ultimate powers to reflect the widespread impact of COVID-19?
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, in my lifetime, I was born just after the Second World War, which, of course, was the sort of major event of the last century. And there's no doubt at all this is the major event of this century so far. And I think, yes, people are being tested, both those who are broadcast journalists and those who listened or watch the output, are being tested equally. It's very easy to keep on with sort of lurid and frightening headlines and playing up the number of deaths, if you like, from one thing, or huge numbers here and all of that, and rather ignoring the fact that what people really need is some advice on how they should proceed. A reasonably calm approach. I think there's been a lot of. I find a lot of it very hard to digest. I don't do it anymore. I retired early last year, from journalism. Still active in broadcasting, but journalism I left behind, and I find a lot of it very, very. I pick and choose a lot. I read a lot more than I listen or watch.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. Joining the Sunday Times in arguably a pivotal time for Britain in the midst of
Sunday Times, are you sure about that?
What did you get wrong there?
Never mind.
So I'll read the question and then you can tell me where he's gone.
Right. Okay.
So joining the Sunday Times in arguably a pivotal time for Britain in the midst of the swinging 60s, in what ways was the press able to echo the social and cultural revolution which was taking place?
So what I actually did, I never went to university. I left school, as soon as I could, really, at the age of 17 in those days, because I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a journalist, or reporter, newspaper reporter, actually. The Sunday Times would have been nice, but actually it was a local newspaper I began on. I worked for big newspapers thereafter, but I started on a local newspaper. And I often say to people say, oh, the swinging 60s, that must have been interesting. Well, not where I was, really. I mean, I loved being a journalist. I loved being a reporter. But it was a very different world where I was. In fact, where I am now. It's the local paper that covers the area where I still live. So I, and it's quite swinging these days. Very trendy. But in those days, it was much more of a kind of ordinary, quietish, although there was a lot of good stories for a reporter going on. So I don't think I was reflecting the swinging 60s much at all in the 60s. Sorry, Josh. Sorry about that.
Well,
Josh has asked, how important do you think local journalism was at that time?
Vital, absolutely vital. There was no social media then. There was no alternatives, really, to local journalism. Our paper, everybody who lived around here read the local paper, which was called the Surrey Mirror. It was vital for covering, looking after what was going on in the courts, in the local councils, local politicians, what they were doing, housing developments, traffic, you know, motorways were coming along. The M25 was being planned when I was there, and that created a big storm, as you can imagine, with local people. So it was vital to tell people what was going on. There was no other mechanism for doing it. We were very lucky indeed. And I always felt privileged that I was sort of at the beginning of events. I could see what was happening and chase things up and keep people informed. It was a fascinating time to be doing it, and people did rely on it, there's no doubt.
Mm. Well, in 1981, you joined the BBC as a reporter for North East Regional News. Mm. Now, as a senior news broadcaster, what do you see as the main differences between regional and national news?
Oh, well, that's a good point. I mean, having worked on a local newspaper and then went and worked in what was then called Fleet Street, the major national newspapers, and then went back, if you like, to regional, local journalism, I was very aware again, even in 1981, again, social media was far in the future. So it was a very important thing to be doing. I always felt that regional news for most people, news about their own area and what was happening, was actually more important to most people in reality than what was happening far away in London or New York or Washington or wherever. There was an old newspaper description, a man called William Randolph Hearst, who was a big newspaper proprietor in America in the early years of the 20th century, in the 1900s. He was as mad as they come and a terrible man in many ways, but he was a very good newspaper man. And he always said, people are more interested about a dogfight in Brooklyn than a war in China. And I think that is still very true. People really are. And actually what's happened lately with social media in all its forms is that that has been proved, because people are gripped and fascinated and want to exchange information about where they are and where they live, and the things that affect them directly, rather than the bigger issues, which are often so far away and so hard to grasp.
Mm. 100%. Well, then you switched to Channel 4 News as business and economics correspondent. How did you find working at such a relatively new current affairs outlet?
Oh, well, Channel 4 News was fascinating. It started along with Channel 4 in 1982, and I joined in 1984. It was only 2 years in. What had happened was, when Channel 4 News started, the people who were running it, which was ITN, which also ran News at 10 and all those programs, they wanted it done very differently, or rather Channel 4 wanted things done very differently, at greater length, at greater depth. And in the beginning, Channel 4 News had hired a lot of people from the newspaper world who were great writers mostly, but not very good on telly. Well, I was very lucky because I'd done a bit of both. I'd worked in newspapers and business journalism. But I'd also done my television work with the BBC, so I combined the two. Well, when I came along, just as a new editor was appointed, an awful lot of people were told, thank you, but goodbye. And we started doing things in a rather different way, still in more depth. Pieces were longer on screen. We spent more time on live interviews. But it was a very interesting time, revolutionary time. And the great thing about it was, but there weren't many of us. Money was reasonably plentiful, so you could go and do and report on things all over the place, all around the world, if you wanted to, which I did. And it was utterly fascinating, and a great time to be doing that sort of thing. Television news was beginning to expand beyond just reporting, you know, the big news of the day, maybe the big politics of the day, maybe a very sad accident or something of that sort, and some human interest stories, into trying to cover things in more depth and try and get behind the headlines, but do it in a way that people wanted to watch it, which is important. If you don't, people don't watch, or people don't listen, or they don't read, there's no point doing it.
No. This leads nicely on. So in terms of icons of political journalism, Britain has had more than its fair share. I'm thinking about Robin Day, Alastair Burnett, Richard Dimbleby and the like. How important were these figures on the direction of broadcast journalism?
Oh, absolutely crucial. I was very, very, very lucky to join in the 1980s where many of these people were still around, of course. Richard Dimbleby had gone, but I met and admired his sons, Jonathan and David Dimbleby. I worked with Alastair Burnett a great deal and other many, many other names that we could have a huge long list, couldn't we? But they were very crucial because you tend to forget that when you look at the television now, there's so many channels and so many people doing it. So many people appear on the screen, whether it's presenters or reporters, foreign correspondents and so on. But it all had to start somewhere. Mm. And when I was there in the mid-1980s, there weren't very many of us. I mean, it was still a young industry, really. And so the guiding lights were all important. And most of those guiding lights had come from the newspaper world, in fact, almost all of them, as indeed I did myself. And they came from the hard school of places like Fleet Street, where, you know, you had to, if you didn't know your stuff, if you didn't do your job properly and well, you didn't get anywhere at all. They were difficult places to do well in. And if you did well in the newspaper world in those days, in Fleet Street particularly, and you had a stab at television, well, it was terrific. But those people were crucial. And I still very, very lucky to have worked with so many of them that taught me so much. And I revere their memory.
Mm. And I suppose one of your most celebrated roles came when you became ITN's royal correspondent. Now, what did this teach you about the royal family's position in modern society?
Well, it was interesting business because, first of all, I had no reason to be a royal correspondent at all. I'm not a great monarchist or anything of that sort, and I'd never considered doing the job. I had actually met Queen, funnily enough, way back in 1991, I think it was. She came to open the ITN building, the new ITN building where I was working, and I met her then. I was the first journalist that she came in the building, apart from the editor, who she met and talked to, and I had a chat with the Queen, so that was nice. But I never imagined that a few years later, the boss would turn around to me and say, well, you're the new Royal Correspondent. If you want to be the Royal Correspondent, that's your job. I mean, right. I was a bit staggered. But I could see that it was a fascinating thing to be doing. Fascinating time. The royal family were having difficult days. The marriage of the Prince and Princess of Wales, Diana, Princess of Wales, was coming to an end, very sadly. It was a time of great technological change. I thought, this is going to be a very interesting job. And so I did it for 6 years. And it was amazing. I mean, there I was alongside the royal family and met almost all of them, had a chance to speak to them. Having met the Queen before, I met her again many times, Prince of Wales, the Queen Mother, even indeed, you know, long gone now. But my goodness me. So I was, it was a staggering thing to be doing for a lad who came from a local newspaper in the 1960s. I can tell you, I was pretty amazed. Every day I thought to myself, am I doing this really? As a bit of journalism, it was unbeatable at the time.
That's right. So Josh has just asked, well, actually, he says he remembers watching an interview you'd done about working on the Queen's speech as well for the first time. I'm going into a small room where you're allowed to watch it, but that leads nicely onto this question, which is you, as royal correspondent, you got a very exclusive first peek of the Queen's Christmas speech each year. What's the process of this, and do you think it's still relevant in the 21st century?
Well, first of all, it's a long, long time since I was involved, so I don't know how it's done now. But in those days, Josh is right, it was about quite a few days, about a week before the speech was actually broadcast, we would be taken, and as I say we, that's to say the ITN correspondent, which was me, BBC royal correspondent, and the Sky News correspondent, we would be taken into a a room in one of the BBC's many buildings that they had in those days, scattered around West London. And first of all, we were told that we weren't to breathe a word of what we were about to see. And it was very important to keep it all secret and everything else. And we were shown the speech. So that it gave us a chance to think about on the day, on Christmas Day, when we would have to report on the speech. It would be played and then we would have to report on it in news bulletins thereafter. Gave you a chance to think about what it was really about and had it succeeded in what it was trying to do and so on. Yeah, I do think the Queen's speech, funnily enough, still has enormous relevance to people. It's surprising, really, but it still gets a very big audience all down the years, and it's maintained it. And it fluctuates a bit according to what's going on, of course, but in the days of Diana and all the things that happened with her, and of course her terrible death and so on, I mean, every time the Queen spoke, people were riveted by it because whatever she said was important. But I think she's also been important at times of national crisis, which we're in now, of course. The unifying effect of the royal family cannot be underestimated. And I think the way that the Queen, who's a good broadcaster herself, she's a good broadcaster. She, several times down the year, many years she's been on the throne, she's proved that she's very good at the medium of TV. And I think it's very, very important indeed. And I am surprised how many young people still think it's an important part of their Christmas Day afternoon. But understandable, fully understandable.
Well, in 1991, you were alongside the late Carol Barnes for the ITN Lunchtime News. Mm-hmm. Now, in your opinion, what is the benefit of a dual presenting team as opposed to an individual newscaster?
Well, I mean, if you've got two people, if it's very busy, then it's a good idea because one can be doing one bit and one can be ready thinking about the next part. Because you've always got people shouting in your ear when you're a news presenter. Directors and producers are telling you what they want you to do. Sometimes while you're talking, they're talking about something else in your ear. You've got to be ready to do that. Can you do that? People say to me, how do you do that? And I always say, well, if you can't, you're in the wrong job. It's quite simple. But it's jolly useful to have somebody with you in those circumstances. But they can be thinking about the next thing and so on. But I'm afraid the times are against it. The economics are against it. And increasingly we see people individually on screen, except on breakfast television, which tends to be a different animal anyway. It's part news, part entertainment, part features. But when it comes to straight news, I think we're getting back to having just the one person who has to get on with it. And that's inevitable in an era when budgets are very, very tight.
What are your memories of working alongside Carol Barnes?
Oh, Carol was my great friend. We just got on so well together from the very start. The thing about Carol was she was the same on screen as off screen. She was a nice person who cared deeply about a lot of things, quite surprisingly, really, because she had a rather rough sort of voice, like that hello, dear boy sort of voice. But she was very passionately committed to social justice. She served as a magistrate. She and I would have long discussions, sometimes arguments about what was going on in the world off screen when we weren't together. And then working with her on screen was just a delight because she was totally professional. But it did help being a great friend as well. I miss Carol a great deal. She passed away far too young and was a great loss to the TV business. Mm.
Moving back to your time as royal correspondent, I suppose the climax of your tenure came in 1997 when you presided over the funeral of Princess Diana. Mm. Now, how difficult was it to gauge the mood of the time?
It was very difficult indeed. The death happened, as everybody who was old enough to remember it, came sort of overnight, early hours of a Sunday morning, as far as the British public were concerned. And I had to go straight into London. And it wasn't so much the funeral, to be honest. That by the time we got to the funeral, which was the following weekend after her terrible death, the public mood had settled down a bit. But in the early phases, it was very difficult to know quite what was going on and how people were reacting. And my job as royal correspondent, I mean, I was on the screen almost all the time. I mean, it was hardly ever off the telly. Amazing week it was. But the boss of ITN was wonderful. He said to me, you're the correspondent. You just tell it like it is. You You don't. Nobody's going to tell you what to say if you tell us. So I would go out whenever I could. I'd get out of the studio and just go into parts of London, go to Buckingham Palace, go to Kensington Palace, talk to people, talk to the police, talk to the public, to try to find out. And things were happening so fast, and the public mood was very up and down, and it was a weird time. It really was a weird time. But the time, we sometimes get accused as particularly broadcast journalists in those days of kind of whipping up the public, and we sort of added to the atmosphere of almost panic that happened to the country, which we didn't. We were very, very careful not to do that. Very careful just to report what we could see and what we could hear and what we were told. When it came to the funeral, well, that was pretty exceptional, of course, but we had prepared ourselves for royal funerals. You have to. So the actual mechanics of doing it was relatively straightforward. But the public reaction, again, was amazing, just to sit there and watch people throwing flowers onto the car as a body was driven away for its final burial. And it was an amazing panorama to watch, amazing thing to be part of. But unprecedented, difficult, yeah, all those things. But, of course, those are the times when journalism is really tested and public mood is tested, and how well you do the job is very, very evident. You're up there, you're very exposed. If you don't do it well, no one's ever going to forgive you for it. Fortunately, we seem to get it about right, thank goodness.
Well, BBC and ITV have always differed in their approaches to programme making. Now, as someone who has straddled both sides of the TV news tree, if you were to briefly sum up those changes, what would they be?
Well, the first thing to say is that the BBC was always very stern and straightforward in its news presentation right from its early days in radio in the 1920s. And by the time we got round to the 1950s, it was still much the same. I mean, it was really, I'm not sure we even saw news presenters in vision very much. It was just very straight reporting of things. And all done in a rather stiff manner. ITN came along, ITV, which called its news service ITN, Independent Television News, came along, changed all that, made it much more interesting, frankly. I mean, news is a fascinating, fascinating thing. And what ITN did was communicate some of that fascination and interest and get people involved. And they chose interesting people to read the news, people with personality, and they chose reporters who were very, very good at getting the stuff together and shooting great pictures and very, very good with the scripts and the words. So ITN really pushed the BBC along like mad. And of course, the BBC did adapt, and the BBC became very, very good at it too. But I still think ITV News still has the edge, really. Short of money, not nearly as many people, tiny organisation compared with the BBC. But in many ways, that's a good thing, because when I worked for ITN, I can remember I would go into the boss and say, "Boss, I think we ought to be doing this." And he'd say, "Righto, okay." Or he might say, "No, I mean, no, you're wrong, you can't do it." But you could get decisions very quickly. Everybody knows the BBC is a huge bureaucracy. It takes an awful lot to move it and change it. And I sometimes, when I watch BBC News and ITV News, I think journalistic standards at the BBC are extremely high. It's the best journalistic organisation across the world, no doubt, because it's the best funded and the most respected and all the other things. But when it comes to actual sort of excitement and grabbing people's interest, ITV is still very, very good at doing that. The BBC, not always good at doing that.
Well, you replaced the great Peter Sissons on Saturday afternoons on the BBC News Channel. Yeah. Tragically, Britain lost the broadcasting titan last year. Mm. In your opinion, what is his legacy on public service broadcasting?
Oh, his legacy is enormous and very personal to me as well. I was very honoured to be able to speak at his funeral as the only person who'd actually worked alongside him as a TV presenter to actually talk to the congregation a little bit about him. His contribution was enormous. I mean, Peter he had one of those wonderful forensic minds, if you like. He's like a very good lawyer. He could have been a barrister. He had that way of just getting in under people's skin, getting the right question, very analytical sort of brain. And I think he was very, very important. He steered Channel 4 News in the 1980s. He was appointed, and other people like me came along as well, but he was appointed as the main anchor, as they call it, because he had this way of getting to the heart of a subject, getting interviews, being polite, always polite, never harangued people, never got shirty with them, didn't interrupt very much, given a bit more time than they tend to have today. But he was, he was a very significant figure. And impersonally, I always say Sissons was one of those who taught me all I know. Well, didn't really teach you, because people like that don't teach you anything. I mean, they're there, and if you're sensible, you learn from them. You watch them and get hints on how to do things and how to deal with situations. And I think for my generation of broadcasters, I think that was true for a lot of people. But I was very lucky. I worked alongside him, became a friend of his. And when he wasn't around, I would go and do his job. Yeah, not as well as him, but I did my best.
Well, being on a rolling news outlet must be a unique experience. And what's the main differences between presenting a long stint of rolling news as opposed to a short bulletin?
Oh, there's a great deal of difference. A great deal of difference. I mean, one of the things about bulletins, whether it's, you know, the BBC, it's the 1 o'clock news, 6 o'clock news, 10 o'clock news and so on, is that it's a program. It's sorted out in advance. It's discussed. It's organized. Everybody has their say. And you're trying to put something together which is going to be good television. And again, people are going to sit and want to watch it. But you're covering everything very carefully. Rolling news is it's like a fairground ride. You don't know where you're going to go. You jump on, I always say it is like a fairground. You sort of hop on when it's your turn, and it whirls round. You know where it's going. Anything can happen in the time that you're on air. You might be on the air for a couple of hours. You might be on the air for longer than that. And things erupt, and the stories go up and stories come down, and things happen, and people come in the studio, and you hope you knew who they are, and people are interviewed very much these days, of course, remotely because of what's been going on with the virus outbreak. You have to keep on top of an awful lot of things at once. It's a very, very different business altogether, a complete separate business in many ways. Funny, there are those presenters who are good at both. I always enjoyed doing both. I thought it was great. It was lovely to work on a bulletin and have a whole team dedicated to getting a nice, smooth program on air. Wasn't always smooth when you got on there, of course, but mostly it was. It had all been planned, and with a bit of luck, it all worked, and that's fine. Whereas at Rolling News, you know, my goodness me, you just never knew from one minute to the next what was going to happen. Great for a journalist. I mean, what journalism should be about. Surprises. I mean, we don't want to. One of the reasons I wanted to be a reporter right back in the earliest days was because I didn't want my days to be predictable. I didn't want to wake up every morning knowing what I was going to do or where I was going to go. I wanted something different. Rolling News certainly does that for you. Oh, my God, yes.
Just two more questions for you, if you don't mind. I know your phone won't operate recently.
That's all right. We're okay. Don't worry about it. Yeah.
So beyond news and current affairs, you also present a successful slot on Classic FM.
Oh, yes.
How important is it for you to present something a little lighter rather than a serious news broadcast?
It's been great. I loved it. For a long time, of course, I did them both. For about 10 years, I was on the radio doing Classic FM, and then I would do news for the BBC as well. Some days I would do it on the same day. I would walk between the BBC's headquarters and Classic FM's headquarters. It took about 20 minutes to walk, and it was always like sort of, you know, adjusting my brain from one place to the other, very different things. But it's been lovely. I've enjoyed it, and now I do only that. I don't involve myself in news at all. I've decided to change. It's been lovely. I just like the fact that it's the music is nice. The listeners are lovely. We seem to be successful at what we do. People are listening in bigger and bigger numbers, which is terrific. We're getting younger people interested in classical music and nice music. It's
when we're driving to and from around the island, I put the Classic FM on in the car, actually, because it is nice, you know. Sometimes other, I'm going to say, younger radio stations, it's too cluttered, you know.
Yeah,
you know where you stand. Yeah. It's very relaxing. Yeah, yeah.
That's the idea. That's what we aim for. I always say I haven't done much lately, but I'm going to be doing a bit more. And I was in Classic and doing a program the other day, and I said to the producer I was working with, you know, the important thing is if we're having fun and enjoying ourselves and sort of finding the thing, the music, agreeable. I wouldn't say relaxing when you're the presenter, because you can't afford to relax. But if you know that what you're doing is relaxing and fun, then the audience will feel the same way. That's my very different from news, but refreshing difference from news, I have to say.
So, looking back at your career, and what is your proudest achievement? And then, what is next for Nicholas Owen?
Well, I suppose you can't escape, really, the thing that if you're very lucky as a journalist, you get remembered for something. And I was a journalist. I added it up when I stopped, and it was 55 years from starting on my local newspaper to actually deciding to say to the BBC, listen, it's been fun, but, you know, always leave the party when it's going, you know, don't hang about too long. 55 years. And I have to look back and think, well, what was the highlight, really? And there's no getting away from the fact it was the royal years. As I say, if you get remembered for anything, you're lucky. And I think I'm amazed people still do remember. I still get people, quite young people to me, who will say, oh, I remember you, because when Diana died, Princess Diana died. So that has to be the highlight. I was fortunate to be in the job. I'm very sorry about the circumstances. I thought it was very sad that the princess died and the country lost a very significant figure when she did. I was so fortunate to be in the position of being at the centre of what was then the biggest story of the day, my father. The story that really touched people in the way that not much news really touches us. This virus, of course, touches everybody, but mostly news is something you go, oh, that's quite interesting, but is it about me? Does it affect me and my family? Well, the princess did, and those royal years did, and so I was very lucky to be there doing that.
And then what's next for yourself?
Well, it's a good question, isn't it? I don't know. You get to a stage where you have to say, is there still things to do? Well, people are still asking me to do things. I mean, everything's gone very strange on hold with the virus. I tend to do a lot of other things. I've always had done sort of corporate work as well. But I'm also very involved in a local charity, various charities, but a local one, particularly very close to where I live, called the Children's Trust. And I fundraise for them. I stand up on my feet and get money out of people, which is always very enjoyable. Mm-hmm. But recently, knowing I have much more time because I've given up the news business, I said to them, well, I'd like to do something a bit more practical for you. And what can I do? I mean, practical? My goodness, me, not practical at anything, really. What else can somebody like me do? Well, there's one thing I can do, and that's drive. And I'm a volunteer driver, and I take people around and take them to their hospital appointments or to visit, you know, may take them home for the weekend if they're, because children there, they say children, young people there are suffering from brain injury, neurodisability, very often having a very difficult life. And so transport is vital to getting them to various things. Sometimes it's them and their parents. Sometimes it's a young person and a nurse. Sometimes it's several young people going off somewhere. And it's terrific. You have to qualify, and you have to, and your driving is taken very seriously, and everything's very closely monitored, and the vehicles are big, and you've got to be a bit careful. But that's sort of that's taking over quite a big part of my life now, which is great, which I'm enjoying enormously.
What's the name of that charity?
The Children's Trust, based at Tadworth in Surrey.
Okay.
As I say, for children with neurodisability and brain injury, and it's a terrific place, and I've been very lucky and very privileged to be involved with them.
Yeah. Perfect. Well, I think, is that all the questions we've got?
Yeah.
Josh, thank you very much. He always enjoys interviewing broadcasters because they know exactly what they're doing.
Thank you to our guest for being the subject of another Beyond the Title interview. If you liked this, why not browse the website and see if there's anything else that takes your fancy? Don't forget to like our Facebook page to receive updates on forthcoming interviews and to see more information about me and what I do. Thanks again, and hopefully see you next time.